From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The American Dream is all about moving up. It's the theme of countless movies, books, and chapters of national folklore. The idea of the land of opportunity has been deep in the country's psyche from the beginning. Now come hints that economic and social mobility in America may be stalling out, giving way to more permanent privilege. Tonight on Point, moving on up and not moving in America, the new reality of American social and economic mobility. But first tonight, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs held confirmation hearings today on Michael Chertoff, President Bush's choice to head the Department of Homeland Security. Chertoff defended his role in developing anti-terrorism policies as an assistant U.S. Attorney General. Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan asked Chertoff what advice he gave the CIA on the use of coercive interrogation methods and specifically on, quote, strapping a subject down and making him experience a feeling of drowning. Chertoff's response?
I am not in a position to evaluate a set of facts based on a hypothetical circumstance. I will tell you, if you are dealing with something that makes you nervous, you better make sure that you are doing the right thing. And you better check it out, and that means doing an honest and diligent examination of what you're doing and not merely putting your head in the sand or turning a blind eye.
To summarize, you would not then have given a yes or no answer to that question?
Correct.
Michael Chertoff today before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. Michael Isikoff is investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine and was at the hearing today. He joins me now from Washington. Michael, what was the tone of questioning today? Was that representative?
That was about as tough as it got. It's interesting because Chertoff acknowledged a degree of involvement in some of the most controversial policies and matters that came up during his tenure at the Justice Department and have been emblematic of what critics have very much given a hard time to the Bush administration, to John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, on, and most recently to Alberto Gonzalez, the nominee to be the next Attorney General.
So Chertoff didn't dodge that? He said, yes, I'm part of the thinking that went into that?
He was a key player. He was probably one of the prime architects of the Justice Department's response to the September 11th terror attacks. And no question about it, but that also embroiled him in some of these, you know, very controversial matters. The torture memo, which he acknowledged that he had seen before it was an early draft of and was consulted on various techniques on, as well as the mass roundup of detainees of Arab and Muslim foreign nationals that took place after September 11th. Yet he didn't get the kind of tough questions that Gonzalez got, the kind of grilling that Gonzalez got, in part because he's a much more skillful witness. He's been around the block a few times.
Been a prosecutor a long time.
He's been a prosecutor. He's very aggressive in responding to questions. And also because he came with a wellspring of support. I mean, he was introduced by bipartisan support. He was introduced by the two Democratic senators from New Jersey, John Corzine and Frank Lautenberg. And there was never any question that he's going to be confirmed for the job. So the Democrats chose not to go after him in the way they have gone after Gonzalez. And as I say, it's a little surprising, if only because Chertoff did acknowledge a greater degree of involvement in particularly the torture memo than was known before.
So the connection's there, but he wasn't too beat up over it. What about the challenges he's going to face when, as you describe it, he's very likely to be confirmed to head up Department of Homeland Security?
This is an enormously difficult job that has very great managerial challenges. You've got an unwieldy, sprawling agency filled with bureaucratic turf battles. This was 22 different government agencies and departments thrown together into one. It hasn't worked very well. There's been reams of inspector general reports, general accounting reports, showing the dysfunction of various aspects of Homeland Security.
And is there an expectation that Michael Chertoff may bring a different approach than Tom Ridge?
Well, he's a much tougher guy. I mean, there's just no question about it. If you know Mike Chertoff and you've seen him in action, you know, this is a tough, hard-edged, no-nonsense prosecutor who is used to giving commands and expecting them to be fulfilled, and he's just a different kettle of fish than Tom Ridge, who's been running the department until now, who is more a Paul. Mike Chertoff doesn't have a lot of smooth edges, but he commands a great deal of respect because he's fiercely intelligent and very aggressive.
And tough right there today before the Senate on his way to an expected confirmation as head of the Department of Homeland Security. Michael Isikoff, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. It is a story the country loves. Americans climbing from humble beginnings to the top. There's the president's new cabinet and the compelling bootstrap stories of Condoleezza Rice and Alberto Gonzalez. Then there's reality TV and shows like American Idol and The Apprentice, where average Joes and Jills vie for a chance at big success. But what's really going on in American society today? Is America delivering on its promise of open opportunity? Or are the gates coming down on wealth and privilege? Tonight on Point, moving on up and not moving in America. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you one of the 51% of Americans under 30 who expect to be rich one day? Is the American economy still an open playing field all the way to the top? And what's your story? What's your family's story? Are you moving on up or not? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Adrian Wooldridge. He is Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine and recently wrote an article headlined Faltering Meritocracy in America. Adrian Wooldridge, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So we're wondering, here's the British Observer from across the pond looks at America and sees a class society, but Americans pride themselves on being the classless society, the wide open society. You say Americans today are clearly mistaken if they believe they live in the world's most mobile society. On what basis do you say that?
Well, absolutely, I do say that, and I know it'll create a lot of resentment, and I know you fought the American Revolution to be independent from we British, but it does strike me that America is beginning to suffer from a lot of the problems that Britain suffered from in the late 19th and early 20th century. That is that you had a dynamic society, a mobile society that began to calcify into a class society. And the most obvious example of this is your political system. You have a president who is the son of a president, and he fought an election against John Kerry, who's married to one of the richest women in the country, who went to a very posh and exclusive public school. And his predecessor as Democratic champion was Al Gore, the son of a senator who went to a posh and exclusive public school. And his leading challenger for the nomination was Howard Brush Dean, another son of privilege who went to an exclusive public school. And what strikes
raised
me
on Park Avenue, Mr. Dean.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what strikes me as most extraordinary about it is this is there's no outcry about it. If in Britain you had Etonians doing battle with Harrovians to lead the two major parties, you'd have an absolute outcry. In America, you seem to take this as, well, normal. It's not normal. It's a sign of the development of a class society.
I wonder, Adrian Wooldridge, if that's not because Americans may look at politics and discount that. I'm not sure why, but they may, because their belief continues that, well, all right, it's that way in politics, but when it comes to making money, we've all got a chance at the brass ring, so let's not rock the boat here. What about on that side of the ledger, the economic mobility side?
One of the things that strikes me, again, as most striking is how often you're having sons following fathers, daughters following fathers into very prestigious jobs. You can see this across the board. You can see it in Hollywood, which is riddled with nepotism, which is riddled with dynasticism. You can see it in Nashville. You can even see it in NASCAR racing. You can see it in the academic world. I think one of the reasons why there isn't more of an outcry is it's so pervasive in the American world, and you have this peculiar marriage between meritocracy and aristocracy, a blending of the two things, which means that you've got a sort of quasi-meritocracy, quasi-aristocracy, and what this is creating is a barrier to upward mobility or a neglect of the problem of upward mobility.
And does it translate into high income, high wealth staying in a few hands, in a few families, or are people somehow getting around those examples of nepotism to still make the big bucks?
Increasingly it does. I think what we've had in this country since the middle of the 1970s is a huge increase in inequality. And you haven't had anything like a commensurate increase in upward mobility. There is a very complicated dispute amongst economists and sociologists about whether the levels of social mobility are going down or whether they're staying roughly the same. But what everybody agrees on is that the levels of social mobility are not increasing at anything like the rate that inequality is increasing. So what's happening is that people who are born rich are more likely to stay rich. People who are born poor are more likely to stay poor. It's harder to climb up the ladder. Now, there are many, many reasons for that, not least the failure of the education system, but I think it's a really fundamental problem with this country.
And you write that at this point, the correlation between the incomes of fathers and sons is higher in the United States than in Germany, Sweden, Finland, or Canada. I have to say, that really comes as news to me.
Yes, but it's a very, very widely accepted fact. Now, it's there are many other problems with the economies of those countries, not least the very, very high levels of unemployment. America scores hugely by the fact that it's got a more dynamic economy. It's got a more flexible economy. There's more job creation. I noticed that German unemployment at the moment is 11.4%. It means people take longer to get into the workforce.
So we've got the jobs, but whether or not they're carrying people up, the question. Adrian Wilder, we've got to take a short break. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about moving on up in America, about economic and social mobility, and whether the United States is still the opportunity society. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you doing better than your parents? Is the mobility escalator still working? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about economic and social mobility in America and whether it's still working or if privilege is becoming more permanent in this country. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you feel privilege congealing in America around an upper class? Is it more true today that them that's got, get? And what about the bootstrap stories of Condi Rice and Al Gonzalez? Are these representative, or is George W. Bush's story more indicative of the time we live in? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking tonight with Adrian Wooldridge. He's Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine, author of The Right Nation. He's joined us from Washington. Now with us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Samuel Bowles. He's research professor and director of the Behavioral Sciences Program at the Santa Fe Institute, research professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, co-editor of the new book, just out, Unequal Chances. Samuel Bowles, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you've studied American issues of mobility for many years now. You know what the polls show. Here I'm looking at a Gallup poll, 2003. 2% of Americans consider themselves rich, but 31% expect to become rich someday. That would seem to indicate a lot of faith in American mobility. Is it well-placed? Do we live in a highly mobile society in social and economic terms?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it. I've been on this problem for a long time. I started working on it in 1970. And I have to say, I don't see that we've made any progress in the direction of the idea that anybody can get the brass ring. The most recent data suggest, for example, that a son whose parents were in the richest tenth of U.S. families was 18 times as likely to end up in the richest tenth himself than would be the son of the poorest tenth. Now, that's a vast discrepancy. If you imagine a ladder with 10 rungs and we're going to assign people to the top rung,
okay.
It's like the children of the rich have 20 lottery tickets and the kids of the poor get just one. I think that's a level of tilted playing field that most Americans think is just wrong. And the anecdotes that you hear, some of them very inspiring, about the bootstrappers and the people who made it, they continue to inspire, and they continue to inspire hope in so many people. But I'm afraid that many of those who expect to be rich, who are now not rich and don't come from rich families, will be sadly disappointed.
Now, I've got to ask you about that. We read David Brooks, no liberal he, in the New York Times, saying We're not supposed to live to have a hereditary class structure in this country, but we're developing one. You say that we're not making progress, but I think a lot of Americans would say, do we need progress? There's an assumption that this has been the land of mobility, of opportunity from the get-go, from the beginning. So where's the need for progress?
Well, sadly, I think the assumption that this has been the land of opportunity is fundamentally wrong, and it has been wrong for a very long time. The data I mentioned are from the 90s, but if you go back earlier, you'll find the same kinds of discrepancies. It goes on at the bottom, too. A child born to the poorest tenth is 13 times more likely to end up poor than a child born to the top tenth. Now, if somebody looks at that and says, now, just imagine that you were one of those kids born to the poorest tenth in the population, how would that look to you? Well, that's a pretty steep playing field tilted in favor of the rich. And I don't imagine that most Americans, conservative or liberal or whatever, looking at those data would say, gosh, that's okay with me. We don't need to make progress. I think wherever you are placed in the income distribution, you'd look at these data and say, well, that really isn't okay.
So how do you interpret the poll numbers that show so many Americans expect it not only that they could become rich, that they will become rich? 51% of Americans 18 through 29, 31% overall, even 8% of those over 65 who aren't yet rich think they'll still become rich. How do you interpret that?
I think people do a lot of work in constructing a life that they can live with and be happy with. And one of the great goals in America is to become rich. And it's not surprising that a lot of people hold that as a hope. Once you give up that hope, then it's a little hard to live. It's a little like if you talk to some guy who's single and you say, well, do you think you're going to have a date this weekend? He'll probably say, yeah, because if he said no, he'd have to admit he was a loser.
Adrian Wooldridge, Samuel Bowles says it's never been quite the open field or maybe anything like it that many Americans believed. But you're making the case that the country is drifting more into a kind of calcified privileged tier and the rest cut off from it. What's the evidence in economic terms that that's going on?
Well, I think if you look at the late 19th and early 20th century, for example, which is the last time you saw huge increases in inequality of the sort we've been seeing the last few years, there was a determined attempt on the part of American elites to create ladders of opportunity. You saw the universities like Harvard going out of their way to admit scholarship children, making it easier for poorer people to get into
university. You're saying after the Gilded Age, after the great inequality, then comes Teddy Roosevelt, then comes the effort to open up the doors to education.
Attempts to abolish inheritance tax. And also at the same time, I think you saw the creation of a sort of corporate career ladder because you had these great giant corporations.
You mean to establish inheritance tax, Teddy Roosevelt, bringing that in as a way of leveling the field a bit.
Exactly. So I think the result of that, plus the result of the New Deal, was to create ladders of opportunity, and also as a result of the New Deal eventually, was to flatten the social hierarchy somewhat. What we've seen over the last 30 years is an increase in inequality without a commensurate attempt to create ladders of upward mobility. And indeed, I think what we've seen is the progressive collapse of schools for the poorer sort of Americans, inner city schools, making it much more difficult for immigrants to rise up the social scale. So no sense, I think, of social commitment to creating a ladder of opportunity of the sort that one associates with the name of Teddy Roosevelt.
I've got to ask you about that. You say that many Americans may not feel this to be the case, that the meritocracy slipping away, because you write that Americans who live in the top, I'm not sure what tier, 20% maybe, an elite you call them, are fighting like crazy all the time to put their children in position of advantage. They live in a very competitive world, and they see within that top 20% lots of competition, lots of judging on merit. You're saying, though, that the competition doesn't include the rest of the ladder, the rest of society.
Absolutely. I think one of the real problems here is that we've had a half-successful meritocratic revolution, and people at the top, people in the professional classes, belong to a very competitive world. If they're lawyers, if they're academics, if they're journalists, they're constantly competing, and they're constantly competing to transmit their privileges to their children by making sure that they get a very good education. It's very hard to get into Harvard. It's very hard to get into the best universities, and they see that they deserve what they've got. But what we have is a competition that only involves a very selected group of people, and you know, these ladders of opportunity and this mechanism of competition doesn't extend down to the poorest people in the barrios of Los Angeles, or you know, in the in the poorer parts of Philadelphia or New York. These ladders of upward mobility have been allowed to decline. And I think it's something that I would blame both the right and the left in this country for doing. I think it's something that we need a very, very general reassessment right across the political spectrum of what's gone wrong with this country.
And yet the ideal of mobility is still very much there. And many would make the case that the reality is there. Adrian Wooldridge, Samuel Bowles, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Russell Roberts. He joins us from Fairfax, Virginia. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of The Invisible Heart, an Economic Romance, currently working on a new book, The Goose That Lays the Golden Eggs, How Markets Create and Sustain the American Standard of Living. Russell Roberts, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening.
So we're hearing the case made that American economic and social mobility has never been what people thought it was, and that it may be getting even tougher now. Even David Brooks, a conservative op-ed columnist in the New York Times, saying we're not supposed to have a hereditary class structure in this country, but we're developing one. Do you agree, Russell Roberts?
Well, I suppose you could have written that line in almost any decade of American life. There's always been this concern that the great promise of the American dream is calcifying, and I'm not nearly as pessimistic as the other two guests who seem to think that the glass is not only half empty, but emptying. I have a much more optimistic and cheerful perspective.
Let's hear it. We're ready.
Well, you look at the data, most of the data that look at this question from between 1970 and 2000, they confound a couple of things. They ignore two enormous changes in American society that make it very difficult to measure these issues of inequality and mobility.
Those being?
One is the change in family structure, an enormous increase since the 70s of single-parent households, particularly female-headed households, which created some poverty simply because of that change.
Do you discount that poverty, or why is that distorting the view, do you say?
It's a measurement problem. If you're going to assess whether there's upward mobility and you take a snapshot in 1970 and you take a snapshot in 2000, which is often what's done, and you ignore the fact that family structure has changed, you're going to get a very pessimistic picture of what any one person's able to achieve.
Because there are more divorced people out there without the same kind of incomes they might have had as a two-income household.
Correct.
Okay.
The other factor that's often ignored, which not only confounds the numbers but gives you a little bit of perspective, is immigration. In 1960 and 1970, we let between 200,000 and 300,000 immigrants into America each year.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s and 90s, that number soared. In the 80s, we were letting in at least 500,000 to a million immigrants every year. And in the early 90s, the same thing. In 1991, we let in almost 2 million folks. That's many, many times bigger than the number of people who came into America in the 70s. Two points to be made, and that number has continued to be very high. Even last year, we let in 700,000 immigrants, year before 1 million, year before 1 million.
How does that impact on the picture of mobility?
Well, it creates a downward measured level of mobility and income and an observed increase in inequality that doesn't capture what's actually going on.
You're saying that should be discounted because these people have just arrived. Of course, they don't have a lot of money.
Exactly. The measured averages then are going to be dragged down to make it look like people are getting worse off, when in fact all we've done is we've added people at the bottom end of the income distribution who came here because they perceive that opportunity. They perceive this still to be the land of opportunity. Of course, many of them do very well once they come here. But the measures, the observed statistical measures of inequality, are misstated for that reason.
Samuel Bowles, let me put those two to you, if I may. Maybe the measurements are just wrong. Russell Roberts says you've got single-income households, you've got new immigrants without a lot of money, and so society looks less equal, looks less mobile, less fluid. Could those be distorting the picture? Have we beyond those factors, do we have roaring mobility here?
Well, I think Russell is correct to say that we don't really have enough data to make a very firm conclusion about whether there is more mobility now than there was 30 or 40 years ago. We just don't have enough data over a long period of time. But there is one measure that we do have a lot of data on, and it's very revealing, and that's about brothers and sisters. If you think about it, the fact that brothers' incomes are very highly correlated.
Is that a fact?
That is it. If you look at one brother and then say we know his income, what does that tell you about the other brother's income? Well, the fact is it tells you a lot. Those incomes are likely to be highly correlated. Now, the same is true of sisters, but not as much as brothers. Now, why is that relevant to us? That's relevant because what do brothers have in common? They have parents in common.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the brothers have parents in common and their incomes are very similar is a very strong clue that parents make a big difference in getting income. Now, about half of the inequality in America can be explained by whatever it is that explains why brothers' incomes are similar. That means parents and also growing up in the same neighborhood and a bunch of other things. Now, the disturbing thing that we can notice is that over the past 20 or 30 years, the correlation between brothers' incomes has been increasing quite dramatically. So the importance of families in determining incomes by that measure is on the rise. And I think that's the best single piece of information that we have on this topic. And unfortunately, it leads us to think that the class structure is calcifying. Though I admit we don't have all the data we would like. I'd also like to mention that that correlation between brothers' income as a measure of how family-oriented the economic lottery is much higher in America than it is in Canada or in Northern Europe. So whatever it is that families are doing for their kids, they're doing it in the United States in spades, and that's part of the structure of the class structure that Adrian talked about when he opened up the program.
Maybe a less fluid structure. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Haviland is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Haviland, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Haviland. You're on, my friend.
Yes, hi. My name is Barry, actually.
Okay, go for it.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to make the point, and I'll actually take my answer off the air. I'm a public school teacher in inner city Boston, and one of the reasons I think that the social mobility has slowed, and I definitely agree with your guest, is that the basic skills and assumptions that people would come to school with no longer exist. In other words, the amount, the basic skills necessary in order to function in the society that people might have come to school with before.
Yep.
Don't exist anymore. And as a result, the pool of people that you're drawing from in order for this mobility to take place has to start at a much higher socioeconomic level. And the people below that just basically don't go anywhere because they've two or three generations or four generations, just there's nothing being taught in the home. A simple thing like how to show up for a job interview, how to be on time.
And so they're not going to even grab that low rung of the ladder, Barry. Thanks very much for your call. Adrian Wooldridge, you describe a picture in which that's going on, and America's not so concerned about it because the movers and shakers, as you said earlier, are intensely involved in a meritocratic struggle. They don't even see those that aren't grabbing on to the ladder from below.
Absolutely. I mean, it strikes me that these two things that we've been talking about, the breakdown of the family, and the arrival of large numbers of immigrants, actually reinforce rather than undermine my case, whatever they do to specific data sets. I think the breakdown of the family, the erosion of social capital, particularly amongst poorer Americans, makes it much more difficult for those people to become educated, to take advantage of the school system, for their parents to spend time helping to educate them, for them to prepare them for school, as the questioner was saying, that this is a real problem, and it's a problem that is contributing to the entrapment of poorer people at the bottom of society.
So just hard to get into. Yes, please.
Secondly, with the immigrants, I think it is absolutely true that we've had a huge influx of immigrants, but I think that the society as a whole is much less good at educating those immigrants, at assimilating those immigrants, and at putting those immigrants on the path to upward social mobility than it was in the late 19th and early 20th century, because schools are not as committed to upward mobility as one would want, because they have less sense of what it is that they're trying to do, what the core sense of a set of values and skills they're trying to transmit is, and because many of them, frankly, have given up or they're spending their time in indulging in things like bilingual education. I think in the early 20th century, you had a real commitment both to upward mobility and a sense
there.
Of what education mm-hmm. was, a sense of mission.
Russell
I
Roberts,
think both these things have broken down.
We hear it. Russell Roberts, let me ask you, we've got a minute before the break here. Adrian Wooldridge points to earlier times. What, Teddy Roosevelt and others said, wait a minute, we don't have the right amount of mobility here. We've got to shake things up and change things for the health of the American society and the American economy. You're saying not so or not needed now.
Well, I think we can always do better. I think the question is, what can we do that will be productive? In the area of education, it remains true today that if you finish high school, you get about a 20% premium in earnings above someone who drops out. If you go on and finish college, you almost double your income relative to somebody who just finishes high school. Our high schools are atrocious. We need to improve our public school system. On the positive side, our university system, the community college system, is much improved over the last 30 or 40 years. We have enormously greater numbers of people going to school, finishing college. But the key to getting out from that bottom rung is finishing high school at a minimum, and that is still an enormous problem in America that we must improve.
Russell Roberts, Samuel Bowles, Adrian Wooldridge, please stand by. We're talking about moving on up in America, about economic and social mobility, and whether the United States is still the opportunity society. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time for a new Teddy Roosevelt to bust up the towers of inheritance and privilege? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about economic and social mobility in America and whether it's still working or if privilege is becoming more permanent. My guest tonight, Russell Roberts from George Mason University, Samuel Bowles from the Santa Fe Institute, and Adrian Wooldridge, Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. You can join us as well. Is the United States developing a hereditary class structure, or is there still gold in the streets for anyone with enough gumption to grab it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to first say I really appreciate the panel tonight. I'm a 28-year-old married individual, and you'd be surprised at the amount of discussion that my peers and I have about this exact topic.
And what's the conversation go like? You're asking yourselves, can we grab the brass ring? Can we make it big? Is it still a possibility for us?
Well, that's exactly it. But just to kind of narrow the scope, I'm a pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of person. I had to go in the military to acquire my education, so did a lot of my close friends.
Yep.
But we also find that there is a definite quid pro quo with corporate America and the education system, meaning that even if you do get a bachelor's degree, you tend to find yourself in a certain regimented tier where you can only advance so far.
So what are you doing now, David?
I had to weigh the pros and cons about going back to school, and I'm now pursuing a graduate degree.
In what, may I ask?
In business, actually.
So you should be in great position to take advantage of upward mobility.
Just because I'm basically, to pay for my education, I'm leveraging my hopeful, prosperous future with a six-figure student loan debt, which will, put constraints on, my ability to save for my children's education in the future.
But isn't that a big bet you're making, in effect, on mobility? Aren't you voting with your feet and saying, I believe in American upward mobility. I'm going to borrow all this money to get it.
I do. I just think that just from seeing what I've seen lately as a younger worker, in order to reach a comfort level where you actually obtain an income that is conducive for having, a single worker family where you can actually have a spouse staying at home to actually raise your children.
It would be nice, but maybe dream on. Let me ask you one other thing, David. You said you had to work your way through school. You went to the military to do it. What about that tier of your peers in age who didn't have to do that, whose parents were paying full ride for them? Do you see them as privileged beyond you, with an unfair leg up or not?
Absolutely, I do. Mostly because in order to do what I had to do, I had to pursue a non-traditional route of college, meaning going to school at night.
Yep.
Which, although a college degree is a college degree, there are still certain weights. So the people that had the privilege of actually taking the quote-unquote traditional routes seem to be placed more rapidly in better jobs. And in turn have progressed much faster than people like myself.
So lucky for them, but you're feeling some kind of gap there, David. Thanks for your call. Samuel Bowles, what about this story? It sounds like David should be in a position, in a great position. He's 28 years old. He's in business school. He should be in a position to cash in on American mobility, and yet he's feeling uncertain about it. Is that just because of something in the air, or does he have reason to feel that way?
Well, first, I want... I want to wish David luck. I mean, I certainly hope he makes it. But I think, David, that you understand that the deck was a little stacked against you, as you mentioned, about your educational opportunities. And I think a whole lot of people have that same feeling. And no one more than African Americans. And I want to put the question of race on the table because it's a very simple story that one thing that parents and kids have similar, and that's what's called race. And one of the reasons why brothers' incomes are so similar, and one of the reasons why the parents' income and the kids' income are similar, is because parents and kids and brothers and sisters tend to be of what's called the same race, and they experience similar opportunities. So that I think that America has a particular problem in this respect because we have a fair amount of racial discrimination persisting in our economy, and we don't have a level playing field for blacks and whites, and that then contributes to this intergenerational conveyor belt whereby the those on top tend to stay on top. And it's just, I think, one of the things that all Americans feel terribly ashamed of, that the color of one's skin is part of how that conveyor belt works.
And not just skin color. If I've got you right, you're seeing that IQ doesn't correlate with mobility as much as genetics, racial or otherwise.
Well, that's absolutely right. It's a surprising fact and has been true for 30 years that when people ask, you know, well, why is it that parents' incomes and kids' incomes when they grow up tend to be similar, people cast around for reasons why it might be. And some think, oh, well, maybe they pass on wealth or maybe it's good looks or, you know, whatever. And then pretty soon the conversation comes around to IQ. Now, most people are surprised to know that the contribution of IQ to parent and child similarity in how their economic status is very small. It's certainly less than one-tenth of the whole conveyor belt that we're talking about. In other words, if everybody had the same IQ, we'd have virtually the same pattern of class structure in terms of how it's reproduced over time.
So it's not just brains. Let's get another call here. Rhodes is calling from Winchester, Kentucky. Hi, Rhodes. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I grew up in Birmingham in the 50s and 60s, and it was an intensely segregated city. But there is a black class, as there's class in the black community as well as in the white community.
Are you speaking to the Condoleezza Rice story here?
Condoleezza Rice was of the upper class in her society.
Her mother a music teacher, as I recall, her father a minister, but he went on, by the time she was a young teenager, I think he was assistant dean at the University of Denver, not exactly nowhere.
Exactly, and so it's a class matter. A racist to me is someone who does not recognize class in another race.
Interesting.
And I think that mistake is made by citing Condoleezza Rice as a bootstrapper because I maintain that she was not.
We take your point, Rhodes, and thanks very much for calling in. Adrian Wooldridge, what about this? Of course, race has been a kind of affirmative action was supposed to be a path to mobility, but Rhodes points out, look, there's class within all races.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the problems with affirmative action is it tends to benefit the children of the professional classes, of people who would probably do pretty well anyway. It's not weighted enough for socioeconomic background. And also, indeed, if you look at the beneficiaries of affirmative action, black beneficiaries of affirmative action in American universities, quite a lot of them are actually foreign. I mean, they're not African Americans who are born in this country. So affirmative action is a very blunt tool for dealing with past racial prejudice. And I think it needs to be much more linked to issues of social disadvantage, economic disadvantage, rather than just taking race as an indicator in itself of disadvantage.
Russell Roberts, you're encouraging everyone tonight to look at the glass not as half empty as half full, and we hear that. And clearly, the polls show Americans very willing to do that, very willing to look optimistically toward great things in their future. Yet there are conservative analysts even today saying, well, we've got to be careful here that we don't get calcified. Are there things that you'd like to see done to make the society more fluid, to pump up the mobility? And would that be good in your view?
Oh, well, absolutely. There are a lot of things that can be done. I think it's important, though, to mention first to a lot of our conversation tonight is about relative status, not absolute status. Your relative status could be unchanged. You could stay in the middle of the pack. You could stay in the bottom third. You can stay in the top third. But your family and your generations can still continue to improve. The poor in America are much better off today than they were even 15 years ago, dramatically better off than they were 50 years ago, and unbelievably, unimaginably better off than they were 100 years ago.
But the rich are many more times better off. Does that matter?
That perhaps is true. It comes back to the caller we were told the deck was stacked against him because he didn't have the privileges that other people have. I don't see it quite that way. I see he had to work harder, but the deck is not stacked against you. If you want to finish school, you can. No one stops you.
But we see real household incomes, lowest fifth, grew by 6.4% between 79 and 2000. The top 1% grew by 184%. You're saying that gap doesn't matter?
No. Well, whether it matters or not, I can't say. I think that's a philosophical question. But more importantly, I think, is that those data are not accurate measures of what happened to an actual person. For example, there was a study done in California between people in 1988 and 2000. The median worker in California between 88 and 2000 lost 7% in real terms. Very depressing. During a time of great expansion, the average worker was getting worse off. We know that there was a lot of wealth created. Surely then it must all be going to the top group. But in fact, those data were misleading because they weren't the same people. When you followed the same people from 1988 to 2000, the average person was 24% better off.
So it's a complex picture, and the time is running down for us to talk about it. But clearly, there's something in the air here. Americans feeling a little antsy with what's going on with mobility, and maybe good reason for that. Russell Roberts at George Mason University, thank you for being with us tonight. We see your glass half full there. Samuel Bowles at the Santa Fe Institute, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Adrian Wooldridge, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Wooldridge, Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. In a moment, a historical look at the dark side of the American dream. This is On Point. American history is star-studded with the great champions of the American dream, the triumph of businessmen like John D. Rockefeller, the marvel of explorers like Lewis and Clark, the leadership of Franklin D. Roosevelt. But there is a dark side to the American dream, the long history of ordinary men and women who tried everything to succeed, but in the end failed. Americans hold special scorn for the term loser. But in a nation that worships success, their stories might say more about the American struggle than the great lions of any age. In this radio diary, history professor Scott Sendidge, author of the new book Born Losers, tells the rich, revealing tale of the American dream gone wrong.
In 1890, a man named J.W. Baumgardner turned 60 years old and thought about his life, which had been, in his own eyes, a failure. He wrote a letter to an old friend of his, a man he hadn't seen or spoken to in 30 years, and this letter was addressed to John D. Rockefeller. The quotation begins, "I was forced to the wall, losing every dollar I had in the world. I drifted westward, Decatur, Springfield, Quincy, Illinois, 2 years in Iowa. It is so many years since you have probably seen my name that you may have entirely forgotten me, but I have watched your career with considerable interest, sometimes thinking how near I came to being a millionaire. Glad to know that you have not forgotten the friendship formed 30 years ago, though our paths have diverged so widely. In writing you, as a matter of course, there was something of sentiment in it, or probably I should not have ventured writing you at all. Yet in asking if you could do anything for me, it was not in the light of charity. I thought that if the proper place could be found for me to drop into, I could fill it with credit to myself and serve your interests. What I am seeking is not a good salary for a soft and easy place, but I would like a little rest from this care and anxiety." In 1844, the Mercantile Agency, which was the credit reporting firm that became Dun & Bradstreet, wrote a report about a man named William Henry Brisbane, who was then living near Cincinnati, Ohio. And the report ran more or less as follows. This is a really nice man, but he inherited $100,000 and ran through it. Almost all of his money is gone. He's been a physician, a farmer, an editor, a publisher, a druggist, never succeeded at any of these things and probably never will. And what I discovered was that William Henry Brisbane had indeed inherited $100,000. He had inherited a slave plantation in Beaufort, South Carolina. But around 1837, he couldn't stand it anymore, and he sold out his plantation, all of his land, and all of the slaves that he had owned. But he got enough to take his family north to Ohio. And he wasn't in Ohio for very long before he began to think about the fact that he had sold out other families in order to deliver his own. He had sold slave families in order to get the money to bring his family north. And gradually those doubts caused him to buy back all of the slaves that he had sold in South Carolina. Of course, having sold them at cut rates, he now had to pay through the nose because his neighbors were so angry at what he had done. And that's where the $100,000 went. He bought back the 22 people whom he had sold before, paid their railroad passage north, and helped them get established in free lives. But he was a loser, and the credit report that said he had never succeeded at anything, had run through a fortune in a very brief period of time, and probably never would succeed at anything, was right in the financial sense. But I always think of William Henry Brisbane as a wonderful example of the point in American history when our moral standards and our financial standards began to diverge. And I think that it's the idea that you can be a very good person and yet be a loser financially, professionally, in your public life, that is the thing that's so bothersome and difficult and painful to us about failure. And William Henry Brisbane was one of the first people to run up against that idea that although he was a very good man, in fact, in my book I call him a great emancipator, he was a very bad businessman. The meaning of failure in America has changed dramatically over the past 200 years. The sentence that we all say to ourselves, "I feel like a failure. You're such a loser." These were sentences that could not have been said by Americans 200 years ago. And you will find newspaper reports and diaries talking about, "I made a failure." And that sounds awkward to our ears, but it tells you that although you could still be blamed for screwing up if you went into business and you lost a lot of money, but the failure was not your identity. "I made a failure" means, yeah, I messed up, but it isn't who I am. "I am a failure" says something profoundly painful and worrisome about who I am. And that's the big change that has taken place in the last 200 years, between seeing failure as something that you're still responsible for but doesn't really define your essence as a human being, to understanding failure as something that negates your entire identity. Look up, look down, that
lonesome road hang down. Scott Sandage is a professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University. His new book is Born Losers, A History of Failure in America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.